The Curbsiders Teach podcast is for entertainment, education, and information purposes only. And the topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any diseases or conditions.
Furthermore, the views and statements expressed on this podcast are solely those of the speakers and should not be interpreted to reflect the official policy or position of any entity. You should always do your homework and give us any feedback.
Welcome back to the Curbsiders Teach, our series on medical education. I'm Dr. Molly Hoyblein, joined by my co-host, Dr. Ira Krishnovskaya. On today's episode, we'll discuss inclusive recruitment and retention with Dr. Erica Johnson. Before we get started with that, Ira, will you remind the audience what we do on this show?
You got it, Molly. We are the health professions podcast for all things education. We use expert interviews to bring you teaching pearls and practice-changing knowledge to inspire the next generation of clinician educators. And we have a fantastic conversation with our guest, Dr. Erica Johnson, tonight. And we cover best practices, her tips, her kind of tricks, all the things that she's done to really recruit and retain an amazingly diverse and community-reflecting workforce.
Dr. Erica N. Johnson is an associate professor of medicine in the Division of Infectious Diseases at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. She currently serves as the program director for the internal medicine residency at Johns Hopkins Bayview Medical Center and associate vice chair for diversity, equity, and inclusion in medical education for the Johns Hopkins Department of Medicine. She remains clinically active in general infectious diseases, HIV medicine, and internal medicine. Her medical education scholarship includes professional identity formation, diversity and inclusion, and teaching about structural competencies.
We're so excited to bring you this season of Curbsiders Teach with the support of and in partnership with the Alliance for Academic Internal Medicine. A reminder that most episodes are available for CME credit through VCU Health CE for all healthcare professionals at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. And thank you to all our Patreon members. If you love the Curbsiders family content and haven't joined yet, please consider supporting us and continuing to create this amazing resource. So without further ado,
let's get to it.
Let's get to it.
So Dr. Johnson, thank you so much for joining us today. We're really excited to chat with you. Do you mind if we call you Erica for this recording?
No, please do.
Perfect. Well, we'd love to start with some rapid fire questions just to get to know you a little bit better. So we like to ask, could you give us a one-liner to describe yourself and maybe include something from outside of medicine?
Sure. So I'm a 47-year-old woman, wife, daughter, sister, auntie, clinician educator, internal medicine residency program director, ID doc, and tennis enthusiast.
Ooh, tennis enthusiast. Did you watch Wimbledon?
I did. I did watch Wimbledon.
Reflections?
Yes. It was a great tournament. I hope that someday I can be there live to watch Wimbledon, but have not quite yet made that yet. I've seen the U.S. Open live, though.
Amazing. Do you play tennis, Erica?
I do play. I used to play a lot. Lately, I haven't played quite as much, but I still love the game and I still try to get out there whenever I can.
That's awesome. Well, is there a book, movie, show, or music media that you maybe have recently enjoyed that you want to share with the audience?
Yeah, I just finished the book Erasure by Percival Everett, for which the movie American Fiction was based on. I read it with my sister cousins, and we have an informal book club, and I really enjoyed it. So I'm looking forward to reading some of Mr. Everett's other books. He's got one out now called James. So
I'm not familiar with that one. What take home or what did you like the most about it?
There were many things I liked about it, but there were lots of references in it to classical literature because the author or the main character in the book is an author and a writer and a professor. And a lot of the classical references were things related to or things that I had read when I was studying classics in college. And so I felt very seen and and reading, you know, reading a sort of a regular book with all of these references to classical literature.
Like, does it follow the plot of American Fiction or does American Fiction follow it? Because that movie was like mind explosion.
Yeah. The book actually goes into depth a bit more, I think, about some of the characters, some of the storylines, as all the books do relative to movies. I think it also sort of updated it a bit more for contemporary times. The book itself was a little over 20 years ago. Oh. So, yeah, you notice little things like that. So I definitely would recommend reading the book first and then watching the movie, but both were great pieces of art.
Cool. Do you have a favorite piece of advice that you like to give to your trainees, or do you have a favorite piece of advice that you've received throughout your career?
Yeah, I often try to remind my trainees that very few people know where their career is going to end up at the beginning of their career. And part of the joy of it is actually just experiencing along the way. So I invite them to really take time and enjoy whatever stage or space they're in, and be open for the serendipity that happens along the way. Mm-hmm. When I began my career, I had no idea I would be a residency director someday, and here I am. So I think I only had that opportunity because I was open to it and because mentors pointed me in the right direction.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I know you love to share picks of the week. So do you have one that you'd like to share?
I do, and I'm having a little bit of an absence seizure because I may have shared this already, but I recently, I'm super late to the game, but I'm recently introduced to Trombone Shorty, and basically his real name is Troy Andrews, and he's a trombone player from New Orleans, and he kind of is just incredible. His music like fuses rock, pop, jazz, funk, hip hop. He started playing the trombone at age 4 and actually was kind of a part of various bands or various kind of horn sections. He was part of Lenny Kravitz's horn section. And recently I came across some of his kind of original work, or he has other people join him to sing. And it's incredible. He's on tour right now, but I thought I could play just like 5 seconds of it if we're okay with that, because I think that's the amount that we can play without a copyright. And I promise this one's better than the last time I played 5 seconds of something where nothing happened. So let me know if you guys can hear this. This is their song, Something Beautiful, and it's Trombone Shorty and Lenny Kravitz. So let me know if you can hear it.
Can you show me something beautiful? Beautiful. Show me something beautiful. Can you show me something beautiful?
Do you hear it?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I'm going to turn it off before we get like banned by copyright. But basically, I've been loving them. He's on tour right now. So he's all around. He's going international. He's going domestic, all around the country. So folks want to check him out. And that was his trombone in the background there. But Lenny Kravitz's voice.
Nice. I love your adding in the background sounds.
And I try. How about you, Molly? You have a pick of the week?
I do. Yeah. I just finished a book last week that I'm still processing. It's called The Darkest Child by Dolores Phillips. And it's a story of a young girl kind of growing up in the Jim Crow South and her experience with her mother who has mental health issues. And it's a very hard book around racism, but also child abuse. And so very sad and hard book, but also like just really beautiful creation of these complex characters and kind of why her mother is struggling to be a mom. And in some ways she's really wonderful, and in some ways she's really terrible, and just a really complex and beautiful book.
Molly, you're making us feel all the feels.
Well, you can read it and feel even more feels. So yeah, well, let's jump into our case to get us talking today about inclusive recruitment and retention. So we have a case from Cashlack Memorial. David is stepping into a new role as program director for his residency, and he knows that diverse teams in healthcare lead to better outcomes, and he wants to ensure that his program reflects the community that his hospital serves. So he's coming to you, Erica, as someone who's had success in this area and is hoping to learn some best practices. So I had the pleasure of hearing you speak at the panel at the Women in Medicine Leadership Development pre-course at the Alliance for Academic Internal Medicine Conference this year. And I was just so impressed by your work as program director at Johns Hopkins Bayview Medical Center. And I was hoping you could share part of your journey or the experiences that led you to become an advocate for diversity in medical education.
Yeah, thank you. I think it all started with our need with the residency program here to feel like we were fulfilling our mission here in Baltimore in terms of taking care of patients in the community and in terms of ensuring that a lot of the scientific advances that were happening here on campus and at other medical institutions all across our city, across the country and world, that those scientific advances also sort of benefited equally the patients in the community. And in thinking about that and the best way to fulfill that, you know, part of it was ensuring representation within our residency program, ensuring that the experiences, lived stories of the residents in our program really matched the vibrancy of that of the people that we take care of in Baltimore, and also ensuring that residents who train in this program understand the history of the relationship between communities in Baltimore and Hopkins, and academic institutions like Hopkins, understand the history of the deserved history of mistrust related to science and communities, and wanted to understand that history, acknowledge that history, and be a part of building relationships and building trust in such a way that we took better care of the community and helped them achieve health goals. And so that was sort of the frame of mind, I think, you know, that we had when we thought about what it looked like to recruit a class that was a lot more representative. And it started with just looking at our policies, looking at the structure of what recruitment looks like, and looking at some of the barriers that people experience differently within that process, and how we might change the structure, which we had complete control over, in a way that helped influence the outcomes we were hoping to achieve, which really was just, you know, bringing more people to train in Baltimore who would really become, you know, true physician citizens here, here in Baltimore.
Erica, this is amazing, because I feel like we can like hear the passion for having a residency that kind of understands its community, that really appreciates the history of the community. Can I ask, like, for you personally, how did you come around to being like, this is the mission of the residency program I direct? Like, or were you a resident at some point and you were like, I'm going to direct a program that reflects the community and I'm going to be the part that like shapes that kind of program? Like, where did that passion come from for you to be an advocate for this type of incredible program?
A lot of it was the program itself has a long history here in Baltimore. Baby Medical Center used to be Baltimore City Hospital. It's had, you know, a long storied history of taking care of communities in Baltimore, regardless of whether or not they, you know, had the best access to care. They could always get care here. And I think in playing that role, it historically has been a very sort of community-centered, relationship-centered place that drew people who wanted to practice in that way here. And so I came to the program and inherited this position. You know, basically, it was already a place that really had that mission, and I was just the steward of it. But I think the other thing that was important to my story is that I'm from here in Baltimore. And, you know, as I lived in these communities in Baltimore and had grown up in and around Hopkins and understanding, you know, some of the history of my parents and grandparents and great-grandparents' experiences around how they thought about medicine and science and academic institutions. And I think understanding that and wanting to be a part of making that real for trainees was something that I hope to bring into this job as residency director.
Amazing. And when you took this role back in 2015, what did the residency program look like? And were there specific metrics, or did you outline, you know, very specific targeted outcomes, or was it more this general mission in terms of sort of reshaping the residency?
Yeah. So, you know, the program was already very community-centered. We had this amazing initiative around relationship-centered care called the Aliki Initiative, which teaches residents skills around partnering with patients and their caregivers and their outpatient providers while they're in the hospital and bridging that transition outside of the hospital. We also had this amazing initiative called Medicine for the Greater Good that encouraged residents to be to learn skills around advocacy and partner with community-based organizations. But I think in terms of how we thought about recruitment, that there was some opportunity there just in thinking about some of the structures that had grown up in or in around academic medicine, that we just made an active choice to address and to try to reduce those barriers. You know, I think that the residency program was already, you know, quite representative, but there's always an opportunity to do more. And when we looked around, we saw, you know, some real opportunities. Specifically, the year that I came in to this program director role, that year and the following year, we actually had declining rates of applicants who were underrepresented in medicine, who ultimately were matriculating into the residency program. And that was something that really got my attention. And that seeing that trend and partnered with what I knew our history was, what I knew our mission was, what a great training experience I knew we had. All of that together, I think, was what inspired us to make the changes that my leadership team made at that time.
And Eric, I know we're going to keep our listeners on our toes to hear more about the changes that you made, because they definitely want to hear those. But can I ask broadly how you all defined both like diversity within your program and really kind of specifically what you wanted? Like, were there percentages? Were there kind of numbers of residents? Was there something maybe quantitative that y'all were really kind of hoping to achieve? I heard you kind of talking about rates changing, but were there particular, I don't know, definitions or metrics or things that you were like, we're going to change this, this, and this is going to be our priority?
Yeah. So, you know, I think we used the AAMC's definition of underrepresented in medicine, and that's a very, very context-specific definition in terms of looking at students, trainees who are from groups that within a specific region may have lower representation within the field of medicine. But I also think we were trying to interpret that in the context of the city that we're in. Baltimore City is a majority minority city. I think we were trying to interpret it also in the context of the fact that diversity includes both visible and invisible representations, and that it was also important to really think about lived experiences and how those experiences really impact the type of physician professional person becomes, or how it contributes just to the richness of the residency community. So yes, I think we started kind of thinking about demographics, but it became so much more than that. And I think that that's been one of the real values of this journey that we've been on in terms of how we've thought about it from a structural barrier standpoint.
And what were some of those structural barriers that you were able to identify, and how were you able to make changes specifically to put those aside?
Yeah, so we knew that it was it could be a real challenge for people applying to a program, for example, not to see other trainees in the program or other faculty in the program who look like them or who were in positions of leadership. And all of that is really a function of something that residency programs control. You know, we control the stories that we tell. And there are a lot of unconscious biases, I think, that can come into how we make choices about the images that we show, the stories that we tell, you know, how we choose to sort of share narratives about our program, or even narratives about Baltimore. And so one of the things we had the leadership team do is, and we were very much influenced by Quinn Caper's piece in Academic Medicine related to the work that he had done for the admissions committee at The Ohio State University School of Medicine. But we followed a sort of similar method where we had all the members of our committee take implicit association tests, and we had conversations in safe spaces about what the experience was like, and then use that as an opportunity to bring to the front of each of our minds our vulnerabilities around unconscious biases and how that might be influencing the process. We also noted another potential structural barrier is there are a lot of new medical schools that have come lately, that have been started lately, founded lately, and many of them have really unique missions. But I think one of the potential structural barriers of a newer school is that admissions committees may just not be as familiar with the school and the record of graduates of the school. But I think one thing that we were really open to looking at is how some of the these very mission-based schools matched up with the mission of the residency program. And that was a really important criteria for us. And so it helped us overlook some of the, you know, potential bias around not having a track record. We also really wanted to help people understand Baltimore and what it means to train in Baltimore and really feel part of the city. And so we built into our recruitment experience an experience in Baltimore, an opportunity for us to tell the story of what our lives are like in Baltimore and the communities that we take care of and how we, our residents, partner with the communities. We did that in a really fun, interactive way. We rented a bus and, you know, took potential applicants on this tour where we were telling the story of our lives in the city. And I think that was something that helped them see what training in place could look like and what it means to be a physician citizen in Baltimore and be a part of that history. So things like that, I think, were the things that we thought about at that time and were able to use effectively in order to create increase the representation of more diverse groups of students and diverse experiences within our residency program.
And Eric, I heard you mention like Quinn Capers' piece and how that kind of was inspiration for y'all in terms of the implicit association tests. And I wonder for like the kind of mission alignment piece between the new schools and the residency and then this incredible kind of like get to know us, get to know the city tour bus experience. Was there something that, you know, a framework or something that kind of inspired you to take on those changes or something that you were kind of like, oh man, this school did this, and so we're inspired further? Or was that just kind of your brainchild because you're awesome and that's what you came up with? Just wondering where those ideas came from.
Yeah, I have a really fantastic team of APDs and chiefs here, and we really grew a lot of this. After, you know, taking the original inspiration from what Dr. Capers wrote, I think a lot of it was just our passion and enthusiasm for the training experience that we had and the mission that we had and our city. And we wanted to share that. And so I think a lot of it just actually grew out of that enthusiasm. And I see now that there are words or concepts or frameworks to sort of describe how we, I think, started thinking about all of, I think many programs, for example, are, you know, really looking at mission and connecting mission with their practices around who they invite for interview and how they establish their rank list. And there's a lot more that's been written about that. I think at the time, though, we really just felt like our mission was really powerful, and we wanted to ensure that the people that we selected to talk to and that we ultimately ranked in the program, it was going to resonate with them in the same way as it did with us.
Amazing. And has that evolved over the years? Have there been aspects that, you know, didn't really work out that seemed too challenging, or aspects that you felt like you hadn't incorporated early on that you felt like you needed to add in?
Yeah, I think as it continued to evolve, you know, the other thing, after we thought about what it meant to have, you know, this really diverse group of learners and with different lived experiences coming into the program, we also then had to think about, well, what does it mean to really succeed in the program, really thrive? And so we started to think about, you know, what thriving looked like and how we could sort of build a structure around resident thriving. And so that was sort of the next phase, thinking about how we individualize mentorship, how we personalize the training journey based on what residents were interested in accomplishing and what they wanted to do after they finished, how we not just mentored, but also sponsored the trainees in our program, and how we thought about well-being. You know, we, I think, completely tried to have an approach around well-being that was very much framed around agency, residency agency in the program, really respecting our residents' ideas and their experiences and using those ideas from their experiences to help make the program better, partnering with them and making those changes and then helping them see how the value of how their input made those changes. So I think things like that were what kind of came later. And as that helped us ensure that residents were thriving in our program, that also became an additional thing that we could share, we could talk about with people who were looking at our program and help inspire them to want to be a part of Hopkins Bayview too.
And Erica, I can imagine that maybe the focus on thriving or this kind of emphasizing the agency may have also come out of a situation where those things weren't happening, right? And that maybe there were challenges along the way in kind of building the type of diverse and really inclusive residency program that you wanted to build. And we'll, you know, we'll get into the federal challenges that came later. But I wonder, were there initial kind of obstacles or maybe challenges you had to overcome in trying to really kind of push some of these changes forward that you initially kind of put forward?
I think one of the main things that we experienced was just our institution is a really big place. You know, Hopkins is a large place. We have two internal medicine residency programs here and lots of fellowships, lots of trainees in general, and faculty with amazing expertise. And so many, many resources. And sometimes having just a plentiful bounty of opportunities can be a little intimidating for new trainees who are coming into a new institution. We also have had a lot of trainees and a lot of faculty experience imposter syndrome and talk openly about their experiences with imposter syndrome. And so that was something sometimes that I think was impacting trainees' experience in terms of how they, you know, embraced everything that was offered here at the institution. And so I think working through some of that, you know, one of the goals of having very deeply personalized mentorship and individualized learning plans was trying to make Hopkins feel a little bit of a smaller place, helping residents identify very specific goals and helping them work towards those goals in ways that felt really productive for them and that ultimately led to them being, you know, really successful here.
And are those like specific pathways that are sort of pre-created that if someone has an interest in primary care or advocacy that they could fall into, or it's something that's really individualized for each trainee?
Yeah, it's a little bit of both. So we have, you know, pathway types that defined experiences for people who are interested in certain career fields. We have the second oldest primary care track in the country. It's been out since 1978. You know, we have opportunities for residents who are interested in becoming clinician educators or interested in doing quality improvement or global health or being physician scientists. But it also was very much about, you know, thinking about each individual resident and what their own interests were, what their experiences had been, what they hadn't experienced yet, and how getting additional experiences would help shape what they hoped to become after residency. And through very personalized one-on-one mentoring experiences, help shape a residency journey for them that truly is unique. One of the ways that we've been able to do that is just through the use of elective time. We allow our residents a lot of freedom in terms of how they think about that. Certainly, they can have clinical experiences here at Hopkins, but we also encourage them to think about clinical experiences in other practice environments that look different than Hopkins. We encourage them to think about career-based or professional-based experiences residents who are interested perhaps in policy, you know, having experiences working with legislators, for example, or residents who are interested in narrative medicine or medical editorialism. I mean, all different types of ways I think that we encourage them to use elective time to help shape their journey. And that is one of the ways we've been able to help residents have a very unique experience that sets them up for success for the next stage for them.
Erica, I love this because it feels like there's so much individualization, personalization. And in the residency program that I'm on the leadership team for, we talk about like agency within structure, and kind of I feel like you have provided that and like, you know, a decade earlier than I feel like people are talking about it. And it's kind of beautiful to watch. I wonder, do you kind of, even before residents enter this incredibly supportive and individualized training program, were there any issues, just to go back to kind of the recruitment piece really quick, were there any issues after kind of the Supreme Court decisions around admissions? Did that change at all how your residency program kind of did the amazing things that y'all did to enhance your kind of residency program community?
It has not. I think one of the reasons is just sort of a technical reason, which is, you know, the decision really is about university admissions and the residency selection process and being a resident is really employment, and it's separate from university admissions. But I do really worry about the possibilities of premature abandonment of really effective initiatives that places have implemented around thinking about principles of diversity, equity, inclusion, belonging in the recruitment process, in the residency experience process, and beyond. And so that's something that's always been top of mind. I think our process, as we developed it almost 10 years ago now, very much was one about holistic review, getting deep into that application, reading really all of the things that our applicants share with us. And it takes a lot of time, but I think that's how we really got to connect with applicants to our program for whom our mission resonated, and really find the people that I think were most likely to want to come and join us and continue the work that we're doing here in Baltimore. So I think that because, we are engaging in holistic review, I think structurally that's a really sound way to do things. And I think there have been some updates to the application process recently, including sections of the application that allow applicants to highlight impactful life experiences and other ways that applicants can tell us or show programs how they connect with their mission in ways that are, completely unrelated to the scope of the Supreme Court decision.
And in seeing all these trainees forge their individual journeys through your program and hopefully really connect with that mission, have you been able to see impacts in the broader community and, those residents staying on, working in primary care jobs, working in the community?
We have, yeah. And that's been the really great thing. And I think it took me a number of years to sort of grow into the program director role in a way that I could see that from this vantage point, we have a lot of influence over how our programs connect with the community, how they support the community, how they support the larger healthcare workforce. So yes, I think that, through having a really thriving primary care track, within our program, we've been able to graduate a lot of residents who went directly into primary care related fields or primary care adjacent subspecialties like geriatrics medicine and are contributing directly to the workforce in that way. I think similarly, we think a lot about some of the undersubscribed disciplines in internal medicine like nephrology and geriatrics and infectious diseases. And so that's something that we're thinking about as we're recruiting applicants into our program. We need people who want to go into those specialties. And so that's a really important way to stand out and connect with mission in a different way. And then a metric that's really important to us and also important to our institution is, are we recruiting people who are going to stay here at Hopkins? Mm. And I think by creating an experience where trainees feel like they can thrive, it helps them want to stay at the institution. And so we've seen increases in the numbers of residents who graduate from our program over the years who stay on for fellowship training here or stay on specifically for jobs in primary care or hospital medicine or subspecialties after they finish fellowship. So that has been around 40% or better over the past 3 years from the Bayview residency program in terms of people who've stayed here within our health system at Hopkins.
Erica, that's incredible. I want to take that high percentage and have it diffused by osmosis across the country to California, specifically to San Francisco. I wonder, we spent a lot of time talking about how the incredible structure that you've created has supported trainees, especially those who have been underrepresented in medicine. I wonder, do some of these same kind of approaches get taken in terms of recruiting and retaining diverse faculty? So, we're talking about people staying on, but even from folks who are coming outside of Bayview, are there kind of initiatives that your team has been a part of or has heard about that has allowed that kind of next layer of recruitment and retention to really thrive?
Yeah, I think Hopkins as an institution has also been doing a lot of work around supporting diverse faculty, even work that I benefited from when I came on to faculty in 2014. For one, within our Department of Medicine, we've had one of the oldest Department of Medicine-based diversity inclusion councils within the country, who for decades has had the mission of supporting recruitment, retention, and promotion. And there are many different interventions, but I think one of the ones that I, you know, experienced as a faculty member is the idea of, you know, after you're recruited on, having a mentorship team and a sponsorship team that's built around you. And so in the same way that we provide that personalized mentorship for our trainees in our program, you know, new faculty are getting that too. And I think that combined with resources and the right kinds of structural support to be able to do the work that you were recruited here to do have been the kinds of things that help people succeed here and get promoted here and want to stay.
And kind of taking a step, I know we're kind of back and forth here with recruitment and retention, but taking a step back to recruitment, we know that certain historically marginalized groups continue to be significantly underrepresented in medical school graduates, be that underrepresented racial groups, be that people with disabilities, be that low-income students. So clearly building a diverse physician workforce needs to start prior to residency. Have you been involved in any earlier pathways to help improve medical school applications and graduations, or do you have any tips or recommendations around that?
Yeah, I think that's incredibly important in terms of starting early. I think students in, you know, K-12 even are already starting to think about what they want to do. And I think it really helps for them to be able to see opportunities of success and be adjacent enough to that that they can sort of imagine that for themselves. There's been a program here started by a former Hopkins student, actually. It's called MERIT, or Medical Education Resources Initiatives for Teens. And it's a program that helps support and provide additional sort of research-based opportunities, clinical experiential opportunities for high school students here in Baltimore who are interested in careers in biomedical sciences. And so they have additional STEM coursework that they do on their Saturdays. They spend their summers on campus working in a research lab or doing a community-based project or shadowing clinically. And they have additional support as they go through the process of applying to college and ultimately applying to grad school if that's their choice. I'm not actively involved in the program, but I've been able to be adjacent to the scholars. And I think programs like that are reaching back into the community and using resources of academic institutions in the community to help support students in the community who might want to grow up and develop biomedical careers and work in the same community are the types of programs that can be really effective. And that program specifically has had some great outcomes. Some of the earliest scholars who joined are now, you know, finishing up graduate school, finishing up medical school. And so it's been really effective in achieving great outcomes.
And Erica, I hear you saying that you're adjacently involved in MERIT. I feel like that's probably a really beautiful underestimate of how involved you are and how much time you put into it. And I'm just thinking about kind of both the holistic review that you're doing for applications and your role kind of as the Associate Vice Chair for Diversity, Equity, and Education. And I just wonder, like, do you have, like, what hours do you have to yourself, and how do you make this, like, work-life integration happen? Because you're creating such an incredible program, you're contributing to earlier in the pathway to increase retention. I wonder, like, how do you keep yourself sharp? How do you keep yourself motivated and, you know, find time for sleep and just like basics there? I know it's a multifold question that we're not supposed to ask.
Yeah. You know, I think it all just comes from a place of love. I've always sort of thought of an Army value of selfless service is one of the Army values that I think that I, you know, have always sort of most identified with. And I, you know, love a city and love this program and this medical center, and the people here love it too, by the way. I mean, that's sort of why it is the place that it is and why its culture has remained stable over such time. I mean, I think we just all feel like we're doing work in the service of the community and trying to help make medicine the best possible public trust. And so when you're involved in multiple overlapping activities that are all sort of aligned around the same kind of mission, and it's in alignment with your personal mission and it's coming from a place of love, I think that makes it all a lot easier in terms of, you know, how you make choices about how you spend your time and how reinvigorated I feel, even in the face of sometimes, you know, longer hours or ever-growing task list. So
yes,
I think that's how.
Amazing. It all comes back to the mission. And do you have any, like if you were talking to yourself back in 2016, any advice now that you've had all this experience and kind of hindsight and sort of leading your early program director self through the process? Any tips or take-homes that you would want to share with your former self?
I did not know, the 2016 version of myself did not know that I would make it to this year, honestly, because, you know, the first few years of being a residency director are hard. And I think one of the things that really helped me in those early years as I was getting my footing was not feeling isolated and feeling like I had a community of other program directors around me who were going through similar experiences and with whom I could share my experience. They could let me know how they had, you know, experienced the same thing. So it normalized that for me. And also they could share with me their successes and how they worked through some of these same problems that I was working through. And I really credit the Academic Alliance for Internal Medicine and specifically the Association of Program Directors in Internal Medicine through providing that sense of community and that opportunity to get to network with other people across the country, which is how I got to meet Molly.
That's amazing. Yeah. Are there, Erica, are there other resources or like communities or things that you turn, places that you turn to, people that you turn to that allowed you to like continue kind of building both the mission, but also having such a successful program kind of along the way?
Yeah. So I think one of the great things now is that there's such an incredible body of literature around, you know, equitable practices in graduate medical education, both on the recruitment side and the creating an inclusive environment around mission-based recruitment and marketing of the programs. And, you know, all of the different themes that we've been touching on today around community-oriented practice and teaching skills around community engagement. So I think they're just incredible experts across the country now that I reach to. You know, if I read something in the literature or attend a great talk, I think that, you know, that sense of being connected across a network of educators who all, you know, have the same sort of goal in mind, which is just to train a healthy, vibrant workforce that looks like America and has experiences in America is, you know, something that really inspires me and that I'm proud to be a part of.
Fantastic. Well, I think this has been a great conversation. So if you want to just leave our listeners with a few take-home points that you want to really hit home.
Yeah. So I think being clear about your program's mission is critically important to going into any recruitment season effectively, or even thinking about how to bring on faculty into the GME program. So that is time well spent thinking about that mission, revising it, and ensuring that it provides an opportunity or sort of the framework that you could use as you think about all the other decisions that you're going to make about recruitment. And then it can also be the framework for all of the decisions that you make about what the training experience should be and what outcomes you're hoping your graduates achieve. And I think, you know, the other great thing about mission is it's something that can help develop a remarkable sense of community within the program in terms of cultivating a sense of connectedness across the trainees and the faculty. So all about mission. Spend time honing your mission.
Erica, that's amazing. I feel like my mission and my heart are growing just listening to you and kind of the ideas for what really constitutes like a mission-oriented training program. I think that's really huge in the time it takes.
Well, thank you so much. This has really been wonderful. And I think just a lot to think about and reflect on and hopefully inspire a lot of us to try to do better in our own programs and try to really think on that mission and take it to the next level.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I really enjoyed the conversation.
Well, Ira, that was a really wonderful conversation with Dr. Johnson. I'm really inspired by just her passion and her dedication to building a workforce that really represents and supports the community in which she works. And I think she just really inspired me to think about, you know, our situation with recruitment and reflect more deeply on what our mission really is and how we can further that.
I'm with you, Molly. I think that there's clearly time that needs to be taken out to analyze the process, and both from like, are we doing holistic review fully, thoroughly enough? Kind of who's involved in that process? Who's at the table reviewing with us? Who's at the table interviewing? And also, once people get here, do we have that kind of super personalized mentorship and sponsorship team? Because I love how she said that there was a team and not just one person. I think that's something to strive for, and I think really inspiring. And I mean, who can forget the Army values of love and service? I gotta shout those out because I think sometimes we forget about those.
This has been another episode of our Curbsiders mini-series, The Curbsiders Teach. Get your show notes at thecurbsiders.com/teach. A special thanks to the Alliance for Academic Internal Medicine for making this season possible. And thanks to Dr. Matt Leto and Dr. Paul Williams for their support in this project. Thanks to the team at Podpace for editing and production support. Until next time, I've been Dr. Molly Hoiblein.
And we're committed to providing you with high-value, practice-changing knowledge. And to do that, we need your feedback. So please subscribe, rate, and review the show on Apple Podcasts or contact us at thecurbsidersteach@gmail.com. A reminder that most episodes are available for CME credit for all healthcare professionals at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. All you have to do is create an account. And just as follow-up, it is in fact selfless service, as the Army values. And I'm Dr. Ira Krasnovska. Thank you for joining us today and letting us bring you a little nugget of medical edutainment. Mm-hmm.